So the first lesson from this lesson was, first thing we do before we do quantification is write better descriptions. These are very typical for the types of things I find on risk registers, and I can really often make no heads or tails out about what this risk really is. So anyway, but this is what we usually as a risk analyst have to deal with, so I'll give you a real world situation. The first one is the archaeological find. Again, it's very specific. It has a specific task, a thing at a specific location with a specific impact. We would call this project specific, meaning we're going to deal with this in a normal engineering way with probability times impact. The second one is the loss of critical manpower causes a delay. Well, this is systemic, and the reason I'm saying is it's a loss of critical manpower. It's not specific. It's not a particular trade, a particular contractor. The owner, contractor doesn't really say much of anything. And delays, what kind of delay? Delay where? Here, there, and all over. It's just basically a worry probably somebody has that this happened on the last job and I'm a little worried we don't have the right people. This is a systemic issue, has to do with your labor situation, you know, the labor of your project and so forth. Now, if they had redone this register and said that, oh, no, we're just talking about the civil crew or the, you know, the carpenters and such area XYZ, now that would become project specific. But that doesn't say that. It's not specific. Third one is horizontal drilling. That is also project specific, meaning it's a specific element of the project, a specific impact that we have to change to an open cut. We can put a probability of an impact on these very simply as engineers. And if anyone disputes what I'm saying, raise your hand and we'll argue it a little bit. The fourth one is the labor rate increase more than anticipated. This would be probably escalation because it simply has to do with the state of the economy, the labor availability at that point in time, and the strengths of the unions and so forth to raise their rates and all of those things. Those are economic issues that we'll address through escalation estimating later. Number five is the wildlife protection. I labeled that systemic, meaning that there are some, it has to do with wildlife and there's some protection requirements, but again, we don't know what agency, what specific law, what specific part of the project this is affecting. We can't really put a probability impact on it because it's very much of a general, broad statement. It would be systemic in the respect that we don't probably have very good communication with the authority. And the risk is not so much the specific permit, but just we don't really understand what they're talking about, and we're worried about it. So it becomes systemic. But again, if there was a specific law, regulation, and a specific effect on your project, that it's the bird landing on this area and we have to put a yellow ribbon around it and we can't work on it that during those 3 weeks, that would be project specific. Number six is the construction manager leave coincides with the negotiation. This is project specific. Specific person, specific situation, specific negotiation, and so forth. Again, we can deal with the probability times impact. The seventh one, early start of detailed engineering results in late changes. I label that systemic. Basically, this is talking about lack of project definition. Business is in a hurry, they're in a rush or whatever. So they started early on the detailed engineering. It's a general statement about engineering. It doesn't talk again about any specific element or scope of the project, any specific trade, any contractor. It's just a general motherhood statement. Number eight, sole sourcing of the main reactor. This is project specific. Even though it has to do with the pricing of the reactor, it's not due to the economy. It's due to the fact that there was a decision made by somebody for whatever reason to sole source it, which is raising the possibility of a high price. Maybe possible. That's very project specific. That is not escalation. And the last one is slow decision making results in delays to procurement and contract. Again, very much a broad issue about decision making, not being very effective or not being timely. That's a very much a key element of systems and system weaknesses is slow decision making, which I'm sure we're all aware of. So that just gives you a flavor of the additional step we need to go through to do the risk quantification methods we're about to cover here. We need to divide the risk into the three different categories, and we're going to quantify them using three different sets of tools. everybody kind of get the gist of this thing? Until you actually get into this in the real world, you know, it doesn't have a whole lot of meaning. But again, one of the other lessons, key lesson is, first thing I do when I go into risk analysis is get better definitions. What are you talking about? What engineering? Who? When? Where? And if they can't put a specific name, place, time, law on it, then it tends to be systemic in nature. And you'll find out that most of the risk in a risk register tend to be these general worry statements as opposed to specific. Okay, now we're going to move on to the quantification. We've done the background on the terminology and so forth in the process. I do want to mention risk quantification, again, is only done at specific points in time in your project lifecycle. Generally, these coincide with the decisions. The decisions on a project are made generally at what are called gates. So how many people are familiar with the phrase phase gate project system? Just everybody. It's pretty universal. Just about everybody now. Well, if you go back to 1980s, nobody really had phase gate systems. They may have had different classes of estimates and so forth, but phase gating really didn't come into its own until the 90s. But now I find every company has a very defined process of defining their scope, developing their project plans, and then going to the decision authorities and getting a decision made. And they have, you know, high expectations of what the state of the deliverables will be and all of that. That's what phase gate systems are about. But it's usually at those gates where we have to bring to bear the high-powered quantification techniques we're talking about. It's only done on an occasional basis. And I think at the far right of the slide, what we're trying to say is it doesn't stop at the sanction. Often projects, generally about 30% in the construction is a point in time I recommend my clients go back and do risk quantification again, because at that point you're pretty much done with engineering. All your underground work is probably pretty much done. A lot of the risk have happened or not happened. It's a good point in time to quantify that risk again. Another rule of thumb is that 30% construction, I find if you do not manage the risk at that point, your project is pretty much doomed. So when I was at IPA, I could count on a handful of a project that was failing at 30% construction that actually could pull it back and recover. So, you know, there's points after the sanction where really good to go in and do this over again. Okay, so now I need to make the business case for why we need to do better practices, why we should quit doing the things that don't work. The state of the industry on our risk quantification is pretty bad. I did a paper on this in 2012 where I took every empirical study I could find for the process industries that I work in, other than IPA, which I commissioned them to do their own paper. So in 2012, we presented dual papers. IPA, all the data they have, which is based on 17,000 projects they have now, and then all of the academic and consultant papers that I could find from the last 50 years. And decided, well, this is reality, because there really is no other published information out there. One thing to take away on the third bullet is that the high end of actual reality is about triple the high end of what's coming out of our, not just you, or my risk analysis that I communicate to management. The reality is not quite an order of magnitude, but triple what we're telling management. We're failing. We're not doing our job. What we're predicting is not reality. This is a snapshot of the difference between reality and what we do. The blue curve, hopefully you guys have enough statistical knowledge. This is a histogram or a frequency distribution. The blue curve is reality, meaning if we look at this, a 1, meaning you came in on the sanctioned amount. A 1.5 means you had a 50% overrun. If you look at the 1.5 or 50% overrun, look how big the area under the curve is to the right hand of that thing. For those of you into statistics, the P90, meaning 10% of the projects overrun by 70% or more. A lot of people scratch their head and say, no, John, that's not in my company. We've never had that. That doesn't happen. I say, it sure does, because at IPA, we look at basically all your actual projects in the big companies. Every academic that went out research found the same thing. There's very much, the project manager is a project manager. We could go on to discussion about the psychology behind this, but people tend not to remember the bad stuff. But in reality, projects fail dismally, and they fail all the time. The other bad news about this, this is not mega projects. So a lot of folks think, well, this is mega project. No, these are just run-of-the-mill projects. They were not small. They were large enough to matter to the company, meaning it was on their strategic capital investments, but these were not mega projects. These were just run-of-the-mill large projects, typical complexity, so forth. Now the red curve is what we estimate, and I have seen your estimates. When I was at IPA for 7 years, I reviewed your risk analysis, I reviewed your estimates. I reviewed the owner estimates, I reviewed the contractor estimates. And I reviewed every risk analysis and looked at it. They all say the same thing. So I can make your life as cost folks or schedule folks real easy. If you want to do your risk analysis, get some scissors, cut that red curve off this piece of paper, and that is basically what every risk analysis I see tells management. Now, they're not quite that much the same, but pretty much the same thing. You know, plus 30, minus 10, plus 20, minus 5. No basis in reality. It's what management wants to hear, and they're real generally happy with this, because if a 30% overrun will not usually destroy the economics of a project. Generally, even when I talk to financiers, people that actually loan the money to projects, they expect a 20 to 30% overrun. That's just when they do their business case at the bank, they add 25% to whatever you say because they don't believe you. And if it flies, then they'll still give you the money. So, you know, management doesn't get excited about plus 30, minus 10 or whatever. Now, if you went in there and told management that you had a 10% chance of overrunning 70% or more, that will destroy the business case. The rate of return will obviously be 3% or some ridiculously low number, and it's going to kill the project. And that's what I said where we have a communication problem. I go in and do a risk analysis. It looks something like that blue curve a lot of time. And management just looks at it and goes, what the heck am I supposed to do with that? Because my project's basically dead in the water. I'll never get by sanction. And the other problem is they usually hire me about 2 weeks before the board meeting. So there's really no time to do anything about it. They were expecting that red curve. So this is a real challenge and a real problem. And I think everybody, I presented this paper actually for the last 4 years, and everybody kind of nods their head and like, and they go home and they do the red curve again. And this, we're not making much difference. Hopefully you guys won't be doing that. But. So anyway, this is another way of looking at it, different graphical representation, reality with the P10, the P90. The P10 being the low side. Now at the beginning, had a question. He said, hey John, we never underrun our projects. Well, look at the low end of that bar. Underrun, basically there's almost nothing underruns, reality. Overruns, the P90 is about 70% on large projects. There's quite a bit of difference on a small project, but large projects, by and large, that's the way it looks. And I'm going to show several iterations of this to try to drive home now how bad this situation. This is the IPA presentation. Now, for those of you who know IPA, these people are PhDs, and I wasn't one of them, but there's a whole bunch of PhDs. They're very smart statisticians. They clean the heck out of the data, they take out escalation, they take out scope change, all that stuff. And so this is the cleanest of the clean. Not only that, but IPA clients tend to be a little better than the average company. If they're benchmarking through IPA, like a Chevron, we've got a couple of Chevron folks, some Shell folks out here, they tend to be the strongest systems, the best projects out there. So this is the best of the best, the cleanest of the data. And that blue curve, which is what we call a class 4 or a FEL 2 estimate, is basically, if you look back on this curve, the same as the blue curve on my meta-analysis of other research. So there's really no difference between what IPA is finding on this best of the best and what I found from the meta-analysis of other publication. So this is reality. There is no other data out there in the process industry that's better than this. This is what we have to deal with. This is what we as quantification people need to forecast. To give you another example, this is a study I did with the Canadian Hydropower Association. Most of the big hydropower folks in Canada, for every province in Canada has a hydropower group, decided they wanted to know how their projects do. So we looked, very much in an IPA kind of way, but we didn't use IPA. But again, this is the range of their estimates. How many of you are familiar with the Horn curve, or the fact that accuracy gets supposed to get better as you get better defined? That's what this curve is. On the left, very poorly defined project, big range. In the worst case, on the blue, is plus 100, minus 50. That's the AACE high range, high range. Well, if you look at the hydropower, the actual reality is that they overran by 200% and never underran to classify them. You can see the bottom end of the red bar does not go under zero. And so every study shows the same thing. We never underrun the class 5. It's not that we couldn't. What we need to do to underrun it is to add 150% contingency. It's a simple answer. How many people do that? None. Everybody at class 5 is adding, they think they're being generous, 25% contingency, 30% contingency, by God. But in reality, these projects double on the average at class 5, and we're not facing up to reality. It's very hard to even conceive it. I myself, as an estimator, have a hard time. I did that estimate. They can't double. That's the best data we have. We just did a project like that. How can that happen? But it does happen. We just don't know what the real scope is. Really comes down to it. At class 5, we just don't know. And we have to face up to the fact we don't know. And it stays that way, even up to class 4. Or FEL 2, or class 3, we still have not that good of knowledge of the scope. We're just not very confident, or not able to communicate that. Now, having said that, how scary that is for large projects, there's one problematic thing in the industry that makes this harder for everything, is small projects are just the opposite. So at IPA, a lot of our projects we looked at were small, you know, 2 million, 3 million, 5 million, Chevron, a small project would be 20 million. But small projects don't behave the same way. It's a complete dichotomy. So in a small project world, where projects tend to be run by the plant management, they have hundreds of small kind of capitalized maintenance projects. They underrun, they overfund them. Basically, they have to crank out 10 projects a week. And every project manager's got 5-10 projects under their wing. They only have 2 hours a week to spend on every project. So instead of doing highly definitive estimates and all of these wonderful processes, in a process plant or in small projects, they tend to just round them up, put allowances in there, and get it through. And if you're a good company and you underrun, you give the money back. And then the next project can pick up the ball and there's money left, and it tends to work. So it's not necessarily a bad thing that you're overfunding them, because they're short in duration and they don't often even carry over from year to year. And the important thing in a process plant and the small projects is to keep the plant running. It's not so much to underrun and to be great on the dollar, it's to get that thing back up in operation quickly and safely, and that's the main objective. So underrunning is not the... Now the other thing on small projects is they tend to be punitive culture. So you have very rough and tough, superintendent of the plant and so forth. So if you overran a lot, you're going to get in trouble. So again, people tend to round up and so forth. So the typical small project is overfunded by probably about 20%. So when I was at IPA, and they've actually published some of their articles that, a 20% overestimation is typical. So if they come out on a budget, it's not they're doing a great job. It's just they spent the money that they said. This chart, that little curve on there, you can see that probably about 80% of the projects underran. This is a very good chart because it meant that the projects at this was a refinery in East Coast US, this composition of all their small projects for 1 year, a good story because they were giving the money back. And the funny takeaway from this is if you ever see a curve, a historical curve from a company and says, here's my curve, my actual historical curve, and it looks like that red line, you probably have the worst project system out there. The more accurate you are, tends to be the worse you are. Because you're accurate, because you're overestimating 20-30% over your peers, and then don't give the money back. You spend every dime of that 20-30%. So every project comes in on budget, on time, A, we have a party at the end of the year. Those tend to be the most expensive companies out there. And at IPA, we saw that again and again. It was kind of a joke. The client would come in, a new client. They'd be waving their chart. See, we're on budget on every project every year. Mr. IPA, put your red stamp on it saying how good we are, we're Class A. And almost invariably, we would find out that they were 20% more expensive than their peer companies because they were overfunding and then spending every dime. And then they would go away until the next vice president came in and decided he wanted to actually fix it, you know. So, did I see your hand? Yeah.
Sorry, I don't understand. In terms of the larger projects, you mentioned their scopes are larger, so it's more undefined. Whereas the smaller ones, like the ones that are underrunning, wouldn't that be, like you just said, processes? So wouldn't they be well defined? You know what's going to happen, so there are more.
Yeah, they tend not to be that well-defined, but on the other hand, the scopes tend to be not very complex. You know, so it's replace the pump, pull the rotor, or something like that. So they're... Well, the large project, because it's big money, everybody's very concerned about the money. They don't want to spend an extra dime, plus the so the contractors don't fatten things up because people you generally have multiple levels of review. People are going to cut, take things out that are extraneous and so forth. So large projects are very aggressive. The base estimate of a large project tends to be pretty good, just the facts. The small project, we review the base estimate, every third item in the estimate will be allowance. It's not very well defined. It'll just say, allow for foundation, because they haven't really had time to design the foundation. You know, allow for the piping. We haven't had time to go out there and measure that pipe, so we just allowed $30,000 for that. Allow. So there's a lot of uncertainty embedded in there, but they tend to round up. They tend to mentally think of the worst case because they don't want to overrun. They don't want to get halfway through the project and run out of money because operations is breathing down their neck to get this project finished. And if they have to go back to accounting to get more money, that adds 2 weeks delay, so they overfund. So it's just, again, actual values out of IPA. That they have their own curves look very much like that. It's a dichotomy, meaning two separate universes. And the problem with this dichotomy is that a lot of the people in the project world maybe come out of the process plant level. They're used to this. And then they get stuck on a big, large project or mega project and think that it's going to underrun. That may be where the vice president came from, was an operations person in the plant. And they don't understand this overrun situation. So this dichotomy causes a real problem. All of my work is large projects. This was an unusual case where I was benchmarking a small process plant, but because 80% of most of our capital budgets is large projects in terms of money, that tends to be the focus of what my work and most people's attention. These projects, while you may have thousands of small projects, my clients, they tend to only add up to maybe 20% of their capital budget. They call it sustaining capital, just to keep the plant running. It's fairly small, but I'm not sure. Did I answer your question? But it is a real dichotomy, different mindset and so forth. But if you bring one mindset to the other side of the equation, you can get into all kinds of communication problems. Now, another special case is on mega projects. And any complex project is when they fail. It's just not incrementally failing a little more than the next project. When I look at the mega project world, there's a bimodal distribution of outcomes, meaning you have projects that they just overrun 20-30%. It meets the IRR, you're okay. And then you have blowouts. And at IPA, you've seen this and has published this, the fact that the distribution of large mega projects is bimodal, meaning you have orderly projects that kind of mediocre, but not so bad. And then you have projects, this is blowout. The typical characteristic of a blowout project is the labor doubles. Anything labor related, meaning engineering, construction labor, and indirects associated with labor, doubles or triples. And it's an attribute of them. And you see the same repetitive outcome on these blowout projects all the time. And so anyway, that's a distinct a mode of failure that you have to bring to the table. When you're doing your nice statistical risk analysis, you don't get bimodal curves, generally, out of your tool. But in reality, that is the reality, is bimodal outcomes. Now, I've come up with a tool that does do this. In order to do that, we have to think about why do these projects seem to stay in a nice orderly state, just kind of mediocre, and then fall off a cliff and the labor doubling. So I have my own hypothesis of the things that cause this tipping point or falling off the cliff. So when I quantify projects per project, it's the second level of analysis I do for mega projects is how close to the edge of this podium am I getting before I fall off of this thing? More data, just dumping data on you. This is on schedule. Now, we've been kind of talking about cost, but this is the actual reality of schedule duration. The chart on the left, this is an old IPA chart on the left, but you can see the average project, large project, overruns its duration completion milestone by 20%. On a three-year project, that's a six-month delay, right? 36 months times 20, that's 7 months. The chart on the right, Construction Industry Institute, I always call it the poor man's IPA. They come back and they study the same issue 5 years later. They always find the same thing. Same thing, 20% on average overrun. How many of you include 20% duration in your schedule for slippage? Nobody. Nobody does that. They're always very aggressive schedule. Maybe they put in a 3-week buffer somewhere. Nobody puts in a 20% on a 40-month project. How many of you add an 8-month contingency? Nobody. How much do they slip? 8 months. So and we see this again and again. I just saw an article last week, I think you saw the same one on LinkedIn, where Ernst & Young said 79% of projects slip their schedule, and it's an average of enormous number of months. Well, surprise, we've known this for 50 years. It's just that we don't get that quantification. We know it's going to happen, but for some reason we just ignore it. Now, the other thing in consideration in our quantification is trading costs for schedule. How many of you have done risk analysis where you do the cost risk analysis in one room, and then another team meets and does a schedule risk analysis in another room? Another bunch of hands going up. You can't do that. There is no distinction between the two. They're just different manifestations of the same thing. Because in reality, when a project starts to fail, management starts trading, meaning that they will preserve the schedule. So when we look at actual historical data, the schedule, if you saw on that last chart, only slips 20%. Now, a lot of these projects were blowouts. In terms of cost, the cost doubled. But on the schedule, it only slipped 20%. It's like, well, that doesn't seem to connect. Well, the reason it blew out on cost is because they were spending every penny they could to hit the completion milestone. They had to preserve that completion because the revenue was important. The most important thing to IRR is the revenue stream. Or they may have had an agreement with another entity that they were going to have liquidated damages or going to have claims or something. So they will spend money to maintain the schedule. So that's the reality. That is what management does. So when we quantify the risk, we cannot go into separate rooms. When a risk comes up, we have to say, how are we going to respond if this risk happens? And the main question is, are we going to do the expensive thing to fix it, or the slow thing and cheap thing? Because every time a risk event happens, we have to react. We have to respond to the risk. So we have to have a discussion of, are we going to spend money, very expensive, or are we going to just let it slip, save some money, but just let the schedule slip? So the takeaway from that slide is that when we quantify the risk, we need to have that same dialogue of how are we going to trade cost for schedule in the actual occurrence of this project. We cannot ignore that and look at schedule as if it's some separate entity. Now, the last slide, I think, in this group here, and we're falling behind. What time is this thing supposed to be over? It's, 12:30? Oh, so we might actually get closer. So the next takeaway is that the most widely used statistically based method is a disaster. I supported this research back in 2004 when I was at IPA. All of our clients at IPA said, well, what's the best risk analysis method, John? How can we study this? So we went out and we asked everybody how they did their risk analysis. and they gave us their forecasts and predictions. And then at IPA, one of the beautiful things at IPA, we can come back 2-3 years later and see how it actually happened, right? So when we studied that, we found out that people that were using what we call line item ranging had no correlation with reality. In fact, often the project had the most risk, had least contingency. It was just a random number generator for line item ranging. What I'm talking about line item ranging is where generally the estimator, they take their estimate, maybe they categorize things, civil, concrete, steel, and then they get the team in the room and they say, what's the range on steel? You, what's the range on steel? Plus 30, minus 10, you know. Oh, what's the range on civil? Plus 10, minus 5, you know. What's the range on mechanical? Plus 20, minus 2, whatever, you know, whatever numbers they come up with. And the answer of the method, every time you run it, it averages 9%. I don't care what the risks are in your register. I don't care what level of scope definition you are or anything else about that project. By golly, you will come out with 9% plus or minus 4%. Now, where am I getting that 9%? IPA also studied that later, is what is the range? Every time people ran this method, that was the average contingency was 9%. One standard deviation plus or minus was 4%, meaning it went from 13 to 5, or 13 to 6 every time. What didn't matter what the real risk or real uncertainty was on the project. So that's why they declared it a disaster, because it actually had no import to the decision, meaning every project has the same contingency. The risk analysis was pointless. Again, we could just discard it and use that red curve that I showed you before, which was the line item type ranging thing. We need to quit doing that method because it doesn't work. And the reason it doesn't work is because an IPA or AACE also came up with the best way to do risk quantification. One of the first principles is A, thou shalt identify the risk. 2, thou shalt quantify that risk. Well, when you do line item ranging, you are not identifying the risk. And you're not quantifying the risk. You're just asking someone what they think about concrete. Though mentally, they may be connecting it to some risk. Who the heck knows what they're actually doing in their head? But engineers, who are usually the people in this team, have really no idea of what the uncertainty in outcomes is. And I can give people all kinds of examples of why that might be so, like concrete. Somebody says plus 30, minus 10. I say, well, what if you start digging and you run into a rock? Or you don't run into any. The rock you thought was there is not there. Well, we'll have to go to piling. Oh, so all of a sudden your concrete just goes away, right? No, that's a plus. Now, piling is plus 700%. Now, what if you had foundation, you expected to have a spread footing, but then the soils won't support the spread footing. Now you have to have caissons 5 feet in diameter down to the bedrock. Now your concrete went up 600%. Is that possible? And the engineer will go, yeah, that could happen. That probably won't happen, but I said, well, why did you tell me plus 30? It's like, well, basically, when you do line item ranging, you're using an estimating, you're really only looking at the estimator's risk, meaning the estimator's confidence in what they did in the quantification. You gave me a drawing, I quantified it, I got a quote, and there's a plus or minus 20% on that quantification and pricing. That's what you get. It has nothing to do with the risks that occur on a project, which would be the bad soil or the change in the type of foundation. Those aren't owner changes. That's just a condition that pops up late in the game. So I hope you can understand that it doesn't work. Now, the good news for those of you that use it is that sometimes it actually works. If you have a good project that has no risk happen, you have a great team, you have a good system, wonderful economic situation, you get 9% contingency. But again, those never happen very rarely. Anyway, that was our first break. Now we're going to talk about what are the best practices for quantification. Now, AACE, I mentioned that we developed a certification for risk management or risk management and decision making. When we got the consultants like myself in a room together and said, well, what's the best method to do risk quantification? What do you think? course, the CPM guy says CPM, you know, and I say the IPA method, and the other consultant says line item ranging. We had no consensus. It was just basically whatever whoever was doing was what they thought was best. So what we did is we got everybody to say, well, are there principles that we can agree to? What should a method do? What should it look like if it was a good method? And we came up with this list that's on the board, and I highlighted a couple things. So one of them is that the method has to link the risk driver or whatever's causing the uncertainty. It has to be a direct, explicit link between that risk and the quantity or the range or whatever you're putting on that thing. So line item ranging immediately kind of fell off the table as a method. Another one was it must be realistic, meaning it must employ or be based in some extent on empiricism, meaning historical data. So if we've had a similar type of project and it always overruns 30%, we can't ignore that. We can't blame it on the last guy that was managing your project. We have to address it in our method explicitly somehow. The third thing was it has to be probabilistic. And that most people now are using probabilistic method, but not always. For instance, escalation. How many people in this room use a probabilistic method to estimate the escalation cost on your project? One, two, three. When I review estimates, I've not been to your company, obviously, because I have never seen a probabilistic escalation estimate. Generally, finance says throw in 3% a year, or the contractor has a big spreadsheet, you know, and they put 8% on steel and 2% on concrete, but they come up with a point number, and that's it. It's the last anyone talks about it. In reality, the uncertainty of escalation in a volatile economy, like the last 15 years have been one up and down after another, is huge. But nobody does it probabilistically. So those are the types of things. When we asked about the principles, we found out that the methods that some of us were individually using weren't consistent with what we said our own principles were. So at AECE, what we did is the principles were documented first in the recommended practice 40R80. And then we went on from there and said, well, let's look at the inventory of methods we have on the tool shelf and which ones pass this test. And once we determine that, we develop recommended practices only for those methods. So line item ranging did not make the cut. You will not find ranging, line item ranging in the AEC toolbox. You will find CPM-based method, but only the CPM that is risk-driven. Now, if you remember, up to 3-4 years ago, CPM method out there was not. It was activity ranging, which was just as bad as cost ranging, meaning you put a plus or minus on a duration of every activity. That also doesn't work. So the only CPM method we recommended was the one where you link the risk drivers in the risk register to the activities explicitly is the only one that passed the method. So in recap, we looked at reality. Go ahead.
How do you link the systemic risks?
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a minute. Systemic is just basically risk number one. We have a parametric historical-based method that generates a distribution of the impact of those risks. That becomes risk number one, and now we do the project-specific risks, roll them in one Monte Carlo. Now on the schedule, we take a hammock over the whole duration from beginning to end. We quantify the schedule risk systemically. The impact is assigned to that hammock, meaning it drives the end date. And then you do your project specific on a normal activity by activity type of basis. So they're integrated, they tie together. And we'll get into that in a bit. Another interesting thing is the research on risk. Going back to John Hackney, who was a founder of AECE in 1965, actually had the first parametric systemic risk model out there in his book on capital management. It was kind of the Bible at the time. And until the 1980s, a lot of companies were going the Hackney method. It was actually in South Africa, I talked to people that are still using the Hackney method. It's a parametric method. In the 1980s, the empirical-based method just fell off the table. Why? Because at risk for Excel came out in the 1980s, and every estimator in the world thought they were risk analysts, started using ranging. So the historical side, which Hackney had started, IPA picked up the ball, Rand Institute research, all historical, empirical, parametric, just vanished off the planet except for IPA. Now the funny thing is the most commonly method used in industry is the parametric method because IPA does it on every project they do. So they run a risk analysis on all of Shell's major projects and all of Chevron's major projects. It's just nobody pays any attention to it. So what we're recommending to you today is use that method, and we'll get into that in a bit. Just throwing more data at you. I showed you the research I did, the research that IPA did recently. These are the foundational studies. So those of you who are going to be experts in risk analysis need to get these documents, study them, because this is really the reason we have phase gate systems, are these two charts. John Hackney showed the level of scope definition versus contingency or cost growth. And then Rand Institute with Ed Merrow as the lead researcher.